Chapter 11. The car only went 30 giant steps before it commenced to bucking and finally cut right off. The vampire guy finally caught up with me. He was looking very surprised. He just tapped on the window with his knuckle. He said, "Roll the window down for a minute, bud." Sometimes it's terrible to have been brought up proper. I couldn't help myself. I rolled the window down just enough so that our words could get in and out, but his hand or claws couldn't. He said, "Okay, what's this?" I said, "Don't you think I can read? How come you carrying real human blood around in your car?" I showed him my jackknife. "I'm gonna warn you. I know how to kill vampires. This knife is genuine, solid 24-carat silver." He put both of his hands over his face and shook his head back and forth a couple of times. He said, "Sweet baby Jesus, why me?" Then he said, "But if you were from Flint, I might think you believed that. But you're a Grand Rapids boy. You got to be smarter than that. If I was a vampire, why have I got that sandwich and bottle of red pop?" I thought for a second. Then the answer jumped out. "Bait!" He put his hands back over his face. This time when he pulled them away, he was laughing. He said, "Bud, if I was a vampire, I wouldn't have to catch little boys. I'd just stick my fangs into one of those bottles and have my supper. Besides, where have you ever heard of a vampire that knew how to drive a car?" That made sense. In all the moving pictures I'd seen and all the books I'd read about vampires, I never could think of seeing one that could drive a car. But I wasn't going to take any chances.
"Could I please see your teeth, sir?"
"What?"
"Your teeth, sir."
The man mumbled something, shook his head again, then leaned close to the window glass and opened his mouth. Now, even though he didn't have fangs, his teeth still looked kind of scary. They looked like they could bite a pretty good grapefruit-sized chunk out of you. Then he said, "Bud, I've got to get this blood to Hurley Hospital in Flint. They need it right away for someone's operation. I can look at you and tell you're far too smart to believe in any nonsense like vampires, son. Now be a good boy and open the door." I pulled the lock up for him and scooted over to the passenger side of the car. I unlocked my door just in case he had any tricks up his sleeve. He got in the car and said, "You'll never know how grateful I am to you, Bud. I'll take that horrible image of you putting the car in gear to drive away while I stood by the side of the road in Owosso, Michigan at 2:30 in the morning to my grave with me. Thank God you don't know how to drive."
"No, sir, but if you'd have showed me some fangs, I'd have learned real quick."
Just in case, I watched the way he put the car in gear, so the next time something like this happened, I'd know how to make a clean getaway. Me and the man headed back toward Flint, driving over the same road it took me so long to walk. Going like this, I was never going to get away from this doggone city. We hadn't been driving for a minute before he started asking a whole slew of questions. Questions that I had to be very careful about giving the right answers to. He said, "Don't you feel bad about worrying your mother like this, Bud Nut Buddy?" "My mother is dead, sir." Most times, if you tell an adult that, they'll leave you alone. But not this man.
"What? I'm sorry to hear that, Bud. So you stay with your daddy?"
"Yes, sir."
"Right in Grand Rapids?"
"Yes, sir."
"What's his name? Does he work for the railroad?"
"No, sir." The seed started sticking its head out further and further. "His name is Herman E. Calloway, and he plays the biggest doggone fiddle you'll ever see." The man shouted,
"What?"
I said,
"Really, sir, I swear for God, it's the biggest fiddle in the world."
He said,
"I know your father. Everybody in Grand Rapids does."
I didn't say anything. He said,
"Well, I'll be. You know, at first glimpse, I wouldn't say you looked that much like Herman. But now that I look at you, I suppose you do. Of course, he's quite a bit bigger, if you know what I mean."
This was the best news I'd had all day. My face nearly split in half from my giant smile.
"Yes, sir. Folks say I'm the spitting image of my old man." He really started shooting the questions at me. So to stop him, I said, "Sir, could I please have the sandwich and the rest of the red pot before I answer any more questions?" He slapped his forehead and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, bud. I was so surprised about who you are and so happy that you didn't drive off that I forgot all about our deal." He handed me the sandwich and the pop and the apple. I was so hungry that I forgot all about scraping the mustard off the bologna sandwich, and even like that, it was the best sandwich I'd ever had in my life. "Bud," he said, "my name's Mr. Lewis. Now, if you were about 15-20 years older, you could call me Lefty, but you're not, so you can't. Mr. Lewis will do just fine." I shoved the part of the sandwich that I was chewing into the side of my mouth so I could say, "Yes, sir, Mr. Lewis, sir." He said, "I'm not ashamed to admit it. You gave me a scare here tonight that I'll never forget. I just know I'll be having nightmares about meeting you for the rest of my life. I'll wake up in a cold sweat many a night with the picture of you and my car pulling away with that blood on the seat. I can see it all now. I'll be sound asleep, deep in the middle of a Dorothy Dandridge dream, when all of a sudden I'll be standing on the side of the road in Owosso, Michigan, at 2:30 in the morning, and I'll be seeing my car and that blood pulling away with nothing of you showing but that little peanut head of yours peeking up over the dash." He looked at me out of the side of his eye. "Anyone ever tell you you got a little peanut head?" I glugged down the pop I'd been swishing around in my mouth and said, "No, sir." "Well," he said, "this may be the first time, but unless you undergo some major surgery, I'll bet it won't be the last."
"Yes, sir."
He waited a second, then sounded kind of disappointed when he said, "Don't take it so seriously, bud. I'm teasing, you know." I started in on the apple.
"Yes, sir."
"Ever been in the Army, bud?"
"No, sir."
"Well, I got to tell you, I haven't heard so many sir since I was back at Fort Gordon in Georgia, training for the big war." I almost said, "Yes, sir," but I looked at him and guessed he was still teasing. I took another drink of the red pop and saw that when I was raising the bottle, I'd accidentally let some of the sandwich slip out of my mouth down into the pop. There were a couple of chunks of chewed-up bread, a blob of bologna, and some of the mustard swimming around in the bottle. The mustard was real pretty. It looked like some kind of magical fog. Every time I moved the bottle, the mustardy smoke went into a different kind of shape. Lefty Lewis said, "How about sharing that pop, bud?" Uh-oh. He took one look and handed it back. He said, "Nothing personal, bud. I've raised 3 kids and have 2 grandkids. I've learned the hard way about drinking after young folks. But I do believe you need to get in and see a doctor soon, son. It looks to me like you've got a serious backwash problem. That's the most food I've ever seen floating around in a bottle of pop. In fact, that doesn't look like red pop anymore. It looks more like red stew." I real quick chugged the rest of the pop down and ate the apple real slow, because I figured as soon as I was done with it, the questions would start up again. Lefty Lewis said, "Aren't you sleepy?" This was perfect. I could pretend I was falling asleep and then come up with some answers that would get me to Grand Rapids for sure. I yawned real big.
"A little bit, sir."
"All right. Here, give me that core. I think the only thing that's left is a seed or two anyway."
I handed him the apple core, and he put it and the wax paper from the sandwich in the paper bag.
"You just stretch out there and have some sleep. In about an hour, you'll be in a nice, comfortable bed. We can have our talk in the morning."
He reached in the back seat and said,
"Here,"
and handed me a jacket.
"You can use this for a blanket."
The jacket smelled real good, like spice and soap. Lefty Lewis said,
"Oh, bud, not buddy. One more thing before you doze off. Could you reach over into that box and hand me one of those bottles of blood? I haven't had a bite to eat all day."
I kept my eyes closed and smiled. I knew I was going to be safe, because I'd never heard of a vampire that could drive a car, and I'd never seen one that had such a good sense of humor. Besides, I kept my jackknife open under my leg, and he looked like he believed me when I told him it was made out of real silver, even though it probably wasn't. As soon as I had the jacket over me, the smell of the spice and soap and the sound of the crickets and toady frogs outside made my eyes get real heavy.
Wow! I must have been real, real tired. Walking and ducking in and out of the bushes between Flynn and Owosso was a lot more work than I thought it was. Most of the time since Mama died, if someone even walks close to where I'm sleeping, I'm up in a flash. My eyes fly open, and I'm looking right at them. At one of the foster houses where I'd stayed, a woman told me she knew I was going to be a criminal, because anyone who sleeps that light has got to have a guilty conscience. Most of the time, the sound of someone else going from sleep breathing to awake breathing in the same room as me is enough to get me up. But this morning, I felt like I was at the bottom of a well that someone had filled with tons of thick chocolate pudding. Someone was calling my name from way up at the top of the well. She was saying, "Bud, Bud, Bud." Waves from the pudding were slogging me back and forth, back and forth. "Bud, wake up, Bud." It was a woman's voice, and her hands were trying to shake me awake. Uh-oh. This is number 29 of my rules. Rules and things number 29. When you wake up and don't know for sure where you're at, and there's a bunch of people standing around you, it's best to pretend you're still asleep until you can figure out what's going on and what you should do. I kept my eyes closed, acting like I was out cold. The woman said, "Papa, what on earth are all these lumps and bites on this baby's face?" A man answered, "Well, he was walking all the way from Grand Rapids to Flint. Looks like he provided a pretty paltry meal for every mosquito on the way." The woman said, "This poor child must be dead. I hate getting him up. I wish he could stay with us for a while, at least until he's had his sleep." Then I remembered who I was with, because Lefty Lewis said, "I know, but I got to get back. He can sleep in the car on the way back to Grand Rapids." The woman rolled back the blanket they'd put over me and said, "Papa, look at his legs. This boy's as skinny as a rail." Shucks. They'd taken off my knickers when they put me in this bed. Now I was going to have to pretend I was asleep even longer, at least until I could figure a way out of being so embarrassed. Lefty Lewis said, "Yeah, he's puny. Good thing his legs don't touch when he walks, because if those two twigs got to rubbing against one another, he'd have a fire going in no time." The woman said, "That's not funny. He doesn't look like he's been fed right. Now, who's his father again? You said you know him." "Everyone in Grand Rapids does. I'm surprised you can't remember him. He's quite a big fish there." "See, I told you it was smart to pretend you were asleep some of the time. Now I was going to learn some things about my father." The woman said, "What kind of man is he that he let this child be so thin? And look at the condition of the boy's clothes. Everything is either too small for him or almost in tatters. Where is this child's mother? There is not much of a woman's touch about him." Lefty Lewis said, "It seems to me that the Mrs. Calloway I knew passed a long time ago. The boy says he's 10. I'm sure she died quite a while before that. But you know how musicians are. There must be at least a few Mrs. Calloways I don't know anything about." That meant that my dad was married to someone before he married my mom. Lefty Lewis's daughter said, "Well, I think it's a sin. I'm of half a mind to keep this boy for a while to put some fear in his daddy's heart, but he probably wouldn't even miss him." Lefty Lewis said, "Now you stop being so judgmental. Herman's got a reputation for being no nonsense, not mean. Does this child have any brothers or sisters?" "I believe he's got a sister, but she'd have to be his half-sister. She must be full grown by now." The woman pulled the blanket back over my legs and shook me again. I was glad I could stop pretending I was asleep. I was sick and tired of hearing about how skinny I am.
and what a mixed-up family I come from. She said real soft,
"Bud, wake up. Come on, sweetie. I've got a nice breakfast waiting for you."
Food. I started blinking and acting like those were the first words I'd heard that morning. I said, "Huh?" like I was kind of confused. The woman smiled real big and said, "Oh, I see that got your attention, didn't it? Good morning, young man."
"Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Lewis." He said, "Hey, you remembered my name. I'm impressed. Good morning, Walking Willie. We got to hit the road in a bit. Better hurry up and get some food in your belly."
He acted like he was whispering just to me when he said, "The food in this joint ain't the best, but I guarantee after you eat here, you won't be hungry for days. This meal's going to be sitting on your stomach like a rock for a good long time."
The woman said, "Ignore him, Bud. My father doesn't mean anything. He just can't stop teasing." I said, "I know, ma'am. He told me I've got a head shaped like a peanut." The woman slapped her father on the arm.
"Papa, I can't believe you've teased this child already. What is on your mind?"
Lefty Lewis rubbed his hand over my head and said,
"Look at this noggin. I rest my case. Boy looks like one of George Washington Carver's experiments sprouted legs and run off. You sure you're not from Tuskegee, Alabama, Bud?"
I said, "No, sir." The woman sucked in her lower lip and swallowed a smile before she said,
"See, Bud, he can't help himself, but he really doesn't mean anything, do you, Papa?"
The way she asked that, you'd have to be pretty stupid not to know how to answer her. Lefty Lewis said,
"Not a thing. It's just that you..."
His daughter spoke up.
"My name is Mrs. Sleet, Bud. Pleased to meet you, ma'am. Now, while you wash up, I'm going to go get some clothes that my boy outgrew a while ago, barely been used. So when you get dressed, you come on down and we'll eat. You chose a great day to visit. We're having a very special breakfast today. Pancakes, sausages, and toast, and a big glass of orange juice. You can meet Scott and Kim, too. How's that sound?"
"That sounds real good, ma'am. Thank you very much."
"Don't mention it. It's a pleasure to have such a well-mannered young visitor."
Mrs. Fleet and Lefty Lewis left the room. As soon as they were a little bit down the hall, I could hear her start in on scolding her father again.
"I just can't believe it. You know, Mama was right about you."
All I could hear next was him mumbling some answer, then her slapping his arm again. After I got out of the bathroom, I saw that Mrs. Sleet had put some clean clothes on the bed. My old clothes were gone, all except for my drawers, which I hadn't taken off. She'd even put clean drawers out for me. So when I put them on, I stuck my old ones down in the pocket of my new pants. I could ditch them when I got to Grand Rapids. It's too embarrassing to have strangers look at your dirty drawers, even if the stranger is as nice as Mrs. Sleet. The new clothes were just a little bit too big, but they were long pants and not knickers, so I didn't care. I rolled cuffs into the pants and sleeves, and they fit pretty doggone good. Man, my first pair of trousers! I let my nose lead me down to where the smell of pancakes and toast was coming from. The Sleets had a room for eating, and it had a great big table right in the middle of it. The first thing I noticed was a huge pile of pancakes sitting on a blue and white plate on top of the table. Lefty Lewis was sitting with Mrs. Sleet's kids. The little girl had a big smile, and the boy was looking at me kind of hard. It wasn't one of those put-up-your-deuce looks. It was just a look that one dog gives another dog that might be passing through his neighborhood. Lefty Lewis said,
"Bud, these two worrisome midgets are my favorite grandkids. Kim is my favorite granddaughter, and Scott is my favorite grandson. Of course, they're my only grandkids, so in fairness, you'd have to say they're also my least favorite grandkids."
These two kids had had a lot of practice being around there teasing old granddad because they didn't pay him no mind at all. I said,
"Hi, my name is Bud, not Buddy."
The little girl said,
"That's a strange name, Bud, not Buddy."
And even though she was kind of young and scrawny to be teasing folks, I could tell that that was exactly what she was doing. Lefty Lewis laughed and said, "That's my girl." Then he went into the kitchen. Scott looked up to make sure the grown folks weren't around and said, "You really run away from home?" I had to stop and think. It's one thing to lie to a grown-up. Most times adults want to hear something that lets them take their attention off you and put it on something else. That makes it easy and not too bad to lie to them. You're really just giving them what they want. It's different when you lie to another kid. Most kids really do want to know what they're asking you. I guess I'd been thinking too long, because he said, "You run all the way from Grand Rapids to Owosso? Was it because your daddy used to beat you?" I could answer that with the swear-for-God truth. Shucks, my daddy never laid a hand on me in his life. "Then how come you run?" I didn't like where I was. That wasn't a lie. "Well, if you're lying about your daddy beating you, you better scram right after breakfast, because my gramps is taking you straight back home." "My daddy never laid a hand on me," the little girl said. "Scott, you talk too much. Let him sit down." Then she told me, "Mama's going to be bringing the sausages in a minute. You like sausages?" "Uh-huh." I'd never had sausages before, but if that was what was making the house smell so good, I was going to love it. Kim said, "Good, because my grandpa brought them all away from Grand Rapids. He always brings us good food, and we're going to share it with you, because Mama says you're our special guest, and we have to treat you nice. Am I being nice?" "So far." "Good. I'll make a deal with you." "Uh-oh. What kind of deal?" "I'll sing a song that I made up all by myself, and when I'm done, I get to ask you one question, and you have to answer, and cross your heart you'll tell the truth."
This didn't sound too bad.
"Okay. Here goes. It took me a very long time to make this song up, so I hope you like it."
The boy said, "Oh, brother."
Kim sang, "Mommy says no, mommy says no, I listen, you don't. Wah ha 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 ha. The building falls down, the building falls down, you get crushed, I don't. Ha 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 ha."
Boy, that was about the worst song I'd ever heard. Kim stood up and bowed like a princess. I clapped my hands together, kind of soft, under the table. She said,
"Thank you very much."
Scott just shook his head.
Kim said, "Okay, that's my part of the deal. Now you've got to keep your part and answer any question I ask."
"Okay."
"Now, you can tell me all about how your mother died."
Scott's foot kicked at her under the table.
I said, "Who told you my mama died?"
The little girl said, "Oops," and stuffed something from her hand into her mouth. "My mama got sick. She died real fast. She didn't feel no pain or no suffering."
Kim said, "I hope my mother never dies."
Scott said, "Stupid. Everybody's got to die."
Kim said, "Ooh, I'm telling Mama you called me stupid."
He said, "You do, and I'll tell her that you've got one of those pancakes in the pocket of your dress." She shut right up. I told her,
"Well, he's right. Everybody's got to die. It's not sad unless they do it real slow and suffer. My mama died so quick and painless that she didn't even have time to close her eyes. She didn't even have time to make a face like she was hurting."
Both of Lefty Lewis's grandkids looked real surprised at this news. Mrs. Sleet came into the room with another blue plate covered with little round pieces of meat. Those had to be the sausages. She saw the way her kids were looking at me, with their mouths half opened, and said,
"Now, you two aren't talking Bud's ear off, are you?"
Scott said,
"No, Mama, I'm not. But Kim's coming real close to."
Kim said,
"I was not. I was just making pleasant conversation."
Mrs. Sleet laughed and set the plate on the table right in front of me. Lefty Lewis came out with a big glass jug filled with orange juice and sat down next to me. Mrs. Sleet sat down and said,
"Scott and Kim, would you say the grace, please?"
Everyone ducked their heads down, and the two kids said,
"God is great. God is good. Let us thank him for our food. Amen."
Then people started passing the big blue plates around and stabbing toast and pancakes and sausages with their forks. I watched to see how much everyone took and tried to take the same.
Then I started to watch how much food the two kids put on their fork every time so I wouldn't look like a pig. Lefty Lewis noticed I was taking a long time and told his daughter,
"See what I told you, Nina? Poor Bud Not Buddy is so skinny and his stomach has shrunk down so much that just smelling the food has got the boy full. Oh, well, I guess that just means more food for the rest of us."
Everyone except for me and Mrs. Sleet yelled a big cheer. Eating with the Sleets and Lefty Lewis was really hard to do, not because they had bad table manners or nothing, but because they talked through the whole breakfast, and they kept trying to get me to talk too. At the home, after grace was said, we weren't allowed to say boo. Eating and being quiet is a hard habit to break. Every time one of these Sleets would talk to me and look at me like they expected an answer, I'd look around first to make sure no one was watching. At the home, if you got caught talking during mealtime, you'd have to get up and leave your food. If these Sleets had to live under those rules, they'd all starve to death. They talked after every swallow. They talked after every drink they took. They talked whilst they were wiping off their lips. Shucks, the little girl Kim talked with milk running down her throat. Some of the time her words got gluggled up in what she was swallowing, and they laughed. Man, did they laugh. It was hard to tell whose story they were laughing at. They were doing so much chattering. Lefty Lewis was talking about radio shows, and Scott was talking about going to a baseball game to watch Lefty Lewis pitch, and Kim was talking about a little girl she didn't like, and Mrs. Sleet was talking about some people called red caps. Kim said to her mother, "Mommy, can't you tell that Bud Not Buddy doesn't know what a red cap is? You got to explain better." Mrs. Sleet said, "Oh, sorry, a Bud? Red caps are the men who work at the railroad station, loading the trains and taking people's bags to their cars. That's what Mr. Lewis does. My husband is a Pullman porter. He takes care of the people once they're on the trains." Kim said, "Yeah, our dad gets to travel all over the country on trains for free." Scott said, "That's 'cause he's working. It's not for free. He gets paid to do it." Lefty Lewis swallowed a big hunk of sausage and said, "And you know what, Bud? I bet the thing he misses most is Nina's cooking. I can't tell you how proud I am of how far my daughter's cooking has come. This might be hard to believe, but she used to be such a bad cook that her fried chicken was known to have turned a chicken hawk into a vegetarian." Scott and Kim and Mrs. Sleet started busting a gut. "Yep," Lefty Lewis said. "I brought a friend to Flint a couple of years ago, and even though I'd warned him, he tried to be polite and ate four of her pancakes. Poor soul held his stomach all the way back to Grand Rapids. Said to me, 'Lefty, I don't mean to show any disrespect, but those weren't pancakes your daughter served me. They were pancakes.'" Mrs. Sleet laughed along with everyone else and said, "Well, I'm sure I don't need to hear any more of this," and picked up the empty sausage plate and went into the kitchen. As soon as she got out of the room, Kim whispered,
"Quick, Grandpa, tell Bud Not Buddy how many times you had to pull a car over when you two were going back to Grand Rapids so that man could get out and vomit on the side of the road."
Before Lefty Lewis could answer, Mrs. Sleet came out of the kitchen with a big wooden spoon and whopped her father a good lick in the head. Chapter 12. After breakfast, me and Mr. Lewis said goodbye to the Sleets and got back into the car. I leaned over the front seat to put my suitcase in the back.
"Mr. Lewis, someone stole all the blood last night."
He said,
"I'll say one thing for you, Bud. When you go to sleep, you go way, way to sleep. You don't remember anything about last night after we got to Flint."
I said, "I don't think so, sir."
"After you so rudely fell asleep on me, we dropped the blood off at Hurley Hospital. Then I gassed up. Then I got in touch with your daddy to let him know you were all right."
"Uh-oh. What did he say, sir?"
"I didn't call him. I sent a telegram to the log cabin. He still owns that club, doesn't he?"
Yes, sir."
"Good."
Lefty Lewis leaned over and reached in the glove box of the car. He pulled out a flimsy piece of yellow paper and handed it to me. Across the top of the paper it said in big letters, "Western Union." Underneath that it said, "Heck, stop. Bud O.K. in Flint, stop. At 4309 North Street, stop. Return 8 p.m. Wed, stop. Lefty, stop.
Man, I'll bet Herman E. Calloway was just as confused by this message as I was. I said, "What does this mean, sir?" Lefty Lewis said,
"When you send a telegram, the more letters you use, the more money you have to pay. So you try to keep your messages as short as you can. Here, let me see it."
I handed him the paper. He said,
"Okay, H-E-C. Now that stands for your dad, Herman E. Calloway. Bud O.K. in Flint. That lets him know how far you got and that you're safe. And you did get pretty far, Bud. But maybe he won't be too hard on you when he sees how resourceful you were at running away. I know I'd have been darn proud of one of my kids if they'd have gotten that far. But I used to offer them money to run, and they'd never take it. At 4309 North Street. That's my daughter's address. And return 8 p.m. WED. Let him know I'm bringing you home by 8 tonight."
I said, "What are all of those stops, sir?" He said,
"That's the telegram office's way of saying period. It just means that the sentence is over."
Lefty Lewis spent most of the day doing errands all around Flint. He made me promise to wait in the car for him. I was good and happy when he said,
"That's it, bud. Time to head home."
We drove past that sign that said "Welcome to Flint" on one side when he looked up and said,
"Uh-oh."
Suddenly, a siren went off, sounding like it was in the back seat of the car. I raised my head up to look over the seat out the back window. Uh-oh was right. There was a Flint police car right behind us with the red light on top of his roof, flashing on and off, and with the siren blasting. They'd found me. Shucks. This doggone FBI was just as good as a movie said it was. They were just like those Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They always got their man. I crouched down as low as I could. Lefty Lewis pulled the car over to the side of the road and said real calm and real slow,
"Bud, it's very important that you listen very carefully to what I'm going to tell you and that you do exactly as I say."
He kept his eyes stuck on the rearview mirror. By the way he was acting, I was starting to think that maybe Lefty Lewis was on the lam, too. And wait a minute. How come this man didn't have a real name? Whoever heard of someone's mama naming them Lefty? That name had alias writ all over it. Lefty sounds like a real good name for a stick-up man. It seemed like it would be real easy for Machine Gun Kelly to point at some poor slob and say, "That's the guy what ratted me out, Lefty. Finish him off." And what he just said about listening carefully and doing exactly what he said was number 8 of Bud Caldwell's rules and things to have a funner life and make a better liar out of yourself. Rules and things number 8. Whenever an adult tells you to listen carefully and talks to you in a real calm voice, do not listen. Run as fast as you can, because something real terrible is just around the corner, especially if the cops are chasing you. I stared at Lefty Lewis, keeping my fingers crossed that the next thing he said wouldn't be, "You'll never take us alive, copper." Instead, he said, "Bud, are you listening, Bud?" I had to play along until I got a chance to make a break. I said,
"Yes, sir."
"Attaboy. First, close your mouth. Good. Now, I want you to take the box that is next to me and quickly put it all the way beneath your seat."
I picked up a box that was about the size of a big, thick book and slid it under my seat. Lefty Lewis said,
"Good boy. Now stay put and don't say anything."
He winked at me and said,
"Don't worry. It's all right."
He opened his door and walked back to the police car. I tried to decide what to do. If I made a break for it, I was sure the coppers would plug me. But maybe Lefty Lewis would wrestle the gun away before they got a good shot off. Or maybe, just maybe, Lefty Lewis would take a bullet for me. Okay, I told myself,
I'm going to count to 10, then I'm going to reach into the back seat, snatch my suitcase, and book out for those buildings. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, I'm going to count to 10 again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, this time I'm really, really going to grab that doggone... The cop and Lefty Lewis were standing at the door. The cop said, "I want to take a look in the trunk." Him and Mr. Lewis went around to the back, and the trunk opened, and I heard someone rumbling around in it. I heard a loud bang and nearly jumped out of my seat. Whew! It was only Mr. Lewis closing the trunk. They walked back to the driver's door. The policeman looked in the back seat and said, "What's in the suitcase?" Mr. Lewis said, "Those are Bud's things. He was visiting here in Flint, and I'm taking him home to Grand Rapids." The policeman looked at me and said, "Oh, your grandson, huh? You two look just alike." Lefty Lewis said, "Why, thank you, officer. I always thought the boy was unusually handsome." The cop didn't have a good sense of humor. He said, "All right, you're free to go. We can't be too careful. I don't know if you heard, but we're having a lot of trouble in the factories here. We've been stopping all cars we don't recognize. There have been reports that some more of those stinking labor organizers might be sneaking up here from Detroit." Mr. Lewis said, "You don't say." The cop said, "Drive carefully," and he touched the brim of his cop hat the way a cowboy in the moving picture does. Lefty Lewis got in the car, started it, and we pulled back out on the highway. He made a scary face at me and said, "Bud, this has really been a couple of lucky days for you. First, I saved you from being eaten by some vampires in Owosso. Then you seem to have survived my daughter's pancakes. And finally, that police officer saves you from the feared and loathsome labor organizers of Detroit. You are truly blessed." Lefty Lewis was back to acting normal, but I kept wondering what was in the box he didn't want the cop to see. I said, "What's a labor organizer, sir?" Mr. Lewis said, "In Flint, they are people who are trying to get unions in the automobile factories." Before I had a chance to get my next question in, Lefty Lewis said, "I'ma save your breath for you, Bud. I'll bet the next thing out of your mouth was gonna be, 'What's a union, right?'"
"Yes, sir."
"A union is like a family. It's when a group of workers get together and try to make things better for themselves and their children."
"That's all, sir?"
"That's all."
"Then why are the cops after them?"
"That's a very good question. Look in that box you put under your seat."
I pulled the box out and put it in my lap and looked over at Lefty Lewis. He looked back at me and checked the rearview mirror.
"Go ahead."
I stopped for a second. Maybe there was a loaded and cocked pistol hiding in the box. Maybe Lefty Lewis would have shot it out with the cop if he tried to take us to jail. I started raising the top off the box, and just as I was about to get it open, Lefty Lewis moved a lot faster than you'd think somebody's granddad could and slapped his hand on top of it, closing it back tight. Uh-oh. Maybe this was loot from a bank that him and Al Capone had knocked over. Maybe Lefty Lewis would have to rub me out if I saw what was inside. Maybe if I looked, I'd know too much. He said,
"Before you look, Bud, you've got to understand that what's in there is very dangerous."
I said, "Well, sir, I really don't think I need to see it, sir. I think I'll just look out the window until we get to Grand Rapids. Or maybe," I gave a big fake yawn,
"maybe I'll take a nap."
He laughed and said,
"Ah, you're a lot smarter than you look, Bud. You know, it would have been curtains for us if that copper would have seen what's in there."
He tapped the top of the box. All I could say was, "Yes, sir." He said,
"Go ahead and open it. But you have to promise. No, you have to swear that you won't breathe a word about what you see to anyone.
Mr. Lewis, sir, I'd really rather take a nap.
Well, first open the box.
I took in a big gulp of air and started to raise the top off the box again. Lefty Lewis yelled,
"Bud!"
I jumped so high I nearly banged my head on the roof of the car. I yelled back,
"Yes, sir! I didn't hear you swear to keep your lips locked."
"Oh, shucks, Mr. Lewis, I swear, but I'd feel a lot better if I could take a doggone nap." I snatched the top off the box and got ready to be scared to death. It was just some paper with writing on it. Maybe the pistol or the loot was under all this paper. I kept lifting paper until I got to the bottom of the box. Nothing. I looked at Lefty Lewis. He said,
"I warned you. Pretty dangerous, isn't it?"
I must have missed something. I went through the box again. "How's some paper dangerous, sir?"
"Read it."
I took one of the papers out. It said, "Attention, railroad workers. The newly formed Grand Rapids branch of the Brotherhood of Pullman Porters will be holding an informational meeting on Wednesday, July 23rd, 1936. All interested parties, please come to 2345 Coldbrook at 9 o'clock. Refreshments will be served. You know what we're up against. Please keep this as confidential as possible." It was starting to make sense. I said, "Mr. Lewis, are you one of those labor organizers?" He laughed.
"Not really, Bud. I'm picking these up so we can pass them out in Grand Rapids. We've been negotiating to get a union for the Pullman porters for years now, and nowhere in Grand Rapids will print these flyers for us. The only place that would do them is all the way in Flint. You were running away to a pretty hot town, young man."
"Wow. That trouble the policeman was talking about at the factory is called a sit-down strike. Instead of walking in front of the plant with signs, the people who are on strike just sit down on their job. That way, the bosses can't bring other people in to steal their jobs. They're going to sit there until the company gives them a union. So the company is trying everything they can think of to get them out. That's why I said those flyers are so dangerous. The people who run the factories and the railroads seem to be really scared. To them, if a worker has any dignity or pride, he can't be doing a good job."
Boy, these automobiles were great for making you conk out. Between the car floating real soft down the road and Lefty Lewis's boring stories about the railroad and the union and baseball, I was out cold in no time. When I woke up, I looked out the window and stretched. Lefty Lewis said,
"I was about to take you to Butterworth Hospital. I thought you'd left the earth for good."
He pointed out of the window and said,
"Looking familiar?"
"Uh-oh." "Yes, sir." I pointed at a gasoline filling station and said, "Yep, there's the gasoline filling station." He said,
"I guess your daddy would have to burn premium in that big packet, wouldn't he? I don't think those big engines can run on ethyl gasoline."
I said, "No, sir, that's right." He told me,
"Well, you and your daddy sure have one beautiful machine."
I was getting real nervous, but I said, "Thank you, sir." We turned another corner and my heart started jumping around in my stomach. Halfway down the street was a building that looked like it was made out of giant chopped-down trees, the log cabin. Uh-oh. Right outside the place was a sign that said, "Appearing Friday through Sunday in July, Herman E. Calloway and the Nubian Knights of the New Deal." My father had joined a new band. Lefty Lewis pulled up next to a car that was as long as a big boat. He said,
"Ah, there's the packet. He's here."
I had to think real fast. I couldn't let Mr. Lewis and Herman E. Calloway talk to each other. If they did, I'd be on the first thing smoking back to Flint. And besides, I felt kind of bad about lying to Mr. Lewis. I wished I didn't have to.
Lefty Lewis cut the car off and pulled the key out of the dashboard. I said,
Mr. Lewis, this is going to be very embarrassing for me.
What is, Bud?
Can I go talk to my father by myself, sir? I swear I'll turn myself in to him.
Lefty Lewis looked at me kind of hard.
Well, Bud, I don't mean to sully your reputation, but you just ran away from that man all the way across the state. I think I'd better hand-deliver you.
But, Mr. Lewis, sir, I need to explain it to him by myself. I promise I'll go in and not run away again.
Lefty Lewis looked out of the windshield like he was thinking. He reached back across the seat and put his hand on the twine keeping my suitcase together. He said,
I'll tell you what, Bud, you don't go anywhere without this, do you?
I said, no, sir.
Okay, here's the deal I'll give you.
He looked at his wristwatch.
5 minutes to talk to your dad alone. If you're not back by then, I'll bring your bag in for you.
It wasn't great, but it would have to do. Besides, it gave me some more time to think.
Please promise that you won't look inside of it, sir.
He raised his hand.
You've got my word.
I got out of the car and walked to the front of the log cabin. The doors looked like they were made out of chopped down trees, just like the rest of the building. I looked back at Lefty Lewis, and he was still watching, so I opened one of the doors. I knew it was one of those doors that Mama had been talking about. I walked in to see what was going to happen. Shucks, there was another set of regular doors inside. The front door closed behind me, and I was in the dark. I tried the other door, and it came open, but I didn't push it all the way in. I waited, then went back out to get my bag. I walked over to the driver's side of Lefty Lewis's car, smiled, and said,
Thank you very much, sir. He's in there. He was so glad to see me that I'm not even in a whole lot of trouble. He's real busy right now and told me to tell you thank you very much and that he'd get a hold of you.
Lefty Lewis smiled, too.
Well, he might be happy now, but if I know anything about your daddy, I expect you're going to be having problems sitting down before this night's over. Now, I know he's going to tell you this, but I got to add my 2 cents. Son, there just aren't too many places a young Negro boy should be traveling by himself, especially not clear across Michigan. There are folks in this state that make your average Ku Kluxer look like John Brown. You know who John Brown is?
No, sir.
Well, that's all right. He's out there moldering somewhere. But the point is, you were very lucky this time. You've got to be good and stay put. I know your dad is not the easiest man in the world, but believe me, he's mellowed a lot from when it was just him and your sister. The next time you're of a mind to do a little traveling, you come on down to the train station. Ask for Lefty Lewis first. I won't tell anyone, but we need to talk before you set out on your own again. Lefty Lewis, think you can remember that name?
Lefty Lewis.
Well, at least he was using the alias all over and not just with me and his family in Flint. He handed my bag out of the window.
Okay, get back on in there and tell your daddy I said hello.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis.
I stood waving until the big car turned out into the street. I sucked in a jumbo gulp of air and opened the front door again. This time I pushed the second set of doors open and walked in. It was dark, but I could see that there were 6 men sitting in a circle on a little stage at the other end of the room. One of them was white. 5 of the men had their eyes on the other guy. One of them had drumsticks in his hands and was leaned over softly tapping out a rhythm on the wooden stage floor. 3 of them were drinking from bottles of pop, and one, a real old one, was using a rag to wipe the inside of a trumpet. The guy who had to be my father was sitting with his back to me wearing a hat. He was talking just like me, and it didn't take much listening to tell he was lying, or at least doing some real good exaggerating just like I do. That was all the proof I needed. His voice was a lot rougher and more tired-sounding than I thought it would be. He leaned back in his chair.
That's right. After I won the Golden Gloves, no one couldn't tell me I wasn't going to be middleweight champ within 2-3 years tops.
The drummer stopped tapping.
Middleweight? What? This was so long ago, gravity wasn't as strong as it is now. Or did a pound just weigh less back then?
The others laughed, but my dad didn't let it bother him.
That's right, middleweight. You got to keep in mind that I had more hair and fewer pounds back then.
He pulled the hat off and rubbed his hands over his glass-smooth head. My dad shaved his hair. That was something I always wanted to do, too. He said,
"My manager goes and lines up a bout against a fighter out of Chicago by the name of Jordan Snaggletooth McNevin. From the name, I'm expecting some young Irish kid with bad teeth. But this guy was one of us, and so old that he could have been a waiter at the Last Supper. When the fight began, I wasn't about to show mercy, you understand?"
All the guys on stage were nodding.
"And to make a long story longer, I go out and flick this halfway stiff right jab clean at Pop's head, and..."
The horn guy said, "Herman, to this day I can't believe you swung at that old man."
"What was I supposed to do, Jimmy? I wasn't trying to kill him or nothing. I just wanted to put him down quick and quiet."
Jimmy went,
And the next thing I know, I'm watching my mouthpiece and my chance to be champ flying out of the ring into the fourth row of seats. I ain't never been hit so hard in my life.
The drummer said, "What? You lost one fight and quit?"
Then Herman E. Calloway said the words that let me know I was right. I felt like someone had cut a light on inside me. I knew it'd been right for me to come all the way from Flint to Grand Rapids to find my dad. The idea that had started as a teeny-weeny seed in a suitcase was now a mighty maple. Herman E. Calloway, my father, said,
"There comes a time when you're doing something and you realize it just doesn't make any sense to keep on doing it. You ain't being a quitter. It's just that the good Lord has seen fit to give you the sense to know. You understand? Enough is enough."
That was the exact same thought I'd had when I got whipped by Toddy Boy. Only two folks with the same blood would think them just alike. I sucked in a big gulp of air, got a good grip on my suitcase, and walked into the light of the stage. The old horn guy, Jimmy, saw me first and said,
"I thought I heard that door open. Did Miss Thomas send you, son?"
I just kept walking onto the stage. I had to see my father's face. I knew we'd look so much alike that the truth would hit him as hard as that Snaggletooth guy had. Even Lefty Lewis said he could tell me and Herman E. Calloway were kin. He turned to see who Jimmy was talking to, and my mighty maple started shaking in the wind. My dad's face was old. My dad's face was real old, just like this horn guy. Maybe too old, but... there was just too much proof that this was my father. He smiled at me. He had his arms crossed over a great big stomach with his head wiping rag hanging out of his right hand. The first thing my dad said to me was,
"Well, well, well, little man, what brings you here? Miss Thomas?"
"I don't know any Miss Thomas, sir."
"So what are you doing here?"
He put his hand over his eyes to shield them from the stage lights and looked out into the dark part of the bar. I noticed how wrinkly my dad's hand was.
"Who brought you here? Your folks out there?"
"No, sir. I'm here to meet my father." Jimmy said,
"Who's your daddy? Why'd he tell you to meet him here?"
I kept looking at Herman E. Calloway. "He didn't tell me to meet him here, sir. I come all the way from Flint to meet my daddy for the very first time." All the men looked over at the drummer. He stopped tapping. He said,
"Oh, man, look, this child ain't no kin of mine. What's your mama's name, boy?"
I said, "You ain't my daddy." I pointed right at Herman E. Calloway's big belly.
"You know it's you."
All the eyes jumped over on Herman E. Calloway. He quit smiling and looked at me a lot harder, like he was really noticing me. I knew if I was a regular kid, I'd be crying buckets of tears now. I didn't want these men to think I was a baby, so I was real glad that my eyes don't cry no more. My nose plugged up, and a little growl came out of my mouth, but I kept my finger pointed, cleared my throat, and said, "I know it's you."
Chapter 13. The circle of men got very quiet.
The younger guys looked like they wanted to laugh but were afraid to, and the Jimmy guy and the man who must be my father were looking at me that way grown-ups do when they're getting ready to give you some bad news or when they're trying to decide which hand they're going to smack you upside the head with. Finally, Jimmy snapped his fingers and said, "Hold on now. Is your name Bud?" He knew my name. I said, "Yes, sir." Jimmy said, "Herman, don't you see? This has something to do with that crazy telegram you got this morning." He looked back at me. "And you said you're from Flint, Bud?" "Yes, sir. That's right. That's right where I'm from." Herman E. Calloway said,
"What in Sam Hill is going on here? First off, don't you be coming in here accusing folks of being your father. And second off, where is your mother?"
Shucks. He said it like he didn't already know. I said, "She's dead, sir. She died 4 years ago." Herman E. Calloway said,
"I'm truly sorry to hear that, but it's obvious that you are a disturbed young man and you don't have a clue who your father is. You just tell us who's looking after you now and we'll get you sent back to wherever it is you belong."
"I belong with you now, sir." Herman E. Calloway said,
"Now you look here."
Jimmy said, "Hold on, Herman." He seemed a lot nicer than this Calloway guy. "Bud, you got to understand, Mr. Calloway here can't be your daddy. No how, no way, nuh-uh. I don't know what gave you that idea, but whatever, we've got to get you back home. Someone in Flint's got to be worried sick about you." I said, "No, sir, I don't have nobody left in Flint. That's why I came all the way here." He said, "No one? No one at all?" I said, "No, sir." He said,
"No brothers?"
"No, sir."
"No sisters?"
"No, sir."
"What about an auntie?"
"No, sir."
"No grandma?"
"No, sir."
Shucks, it looked like this guy was going to go over my whole family tree. But he whistled and said, "So were you living in an orphanage?" Uh-oh. I had to be careful how I answered this. One wrong answer, and I could tell that these guys were ready to give me up to the cops or give me a one-way ticket back to the home. I said,
"Well, sir, I had some problems with some folks that were supposed to be looking after me, and after I hid their shotgun and poured water all over Todd Amos, I busted out of the shed and had to go on the lam. And then I thought it was about time I came and met my father because it's been..." He raised his hand to stop me. "That's fine, son, but just answer what I asked you. What orphanage were you in?"
"Well, sir, I used to be in a home, and then I wasn't, and then I was with some people that were kind of mean, and then I tried to find Miss Hill, but she moved all the way to Chicago, and that was too far to walk, so..."
He raised his hand again to shut me up. "Hold on, Bud. Do me a favor. Go wait by that door for a minute." He pointed to the side of the stage. I walked over and waited to see what was going to happen. I tried pushing the door open a little bit in case I had to make a quick escape, but it was jammed tight. I'd have to leave out of the same door I came in. The man named Jimmy and the guy who had to be my daddy started whispering. After a while, Herman E. Calloway raised his arms and said,
"Hey, but don't forget, this is your little red wagon. You pull it if you want."
Jimmy said, "Fair enough." He waved me back onto the stage. "Bud," he said, "you look like you might be a little hungry, so I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're all done rehearsing, and we're about to head over to the Sweet Pea. You're invited to come along under one condition."
"What, sir?"
"Once you get something in your belly, you've got to be straight with me. You've got some explaining to do. We'll feed you, but you've got to tell us the truth. Do we have a deal?" He stuck his hand out for me to shake, but I wanted to know what I was getting myself into.
"What's the Sweet Pea, sir?" "Best restaurant in Grand Rapids. Is it a deal?"
I don't know how grown-ups can tell. I'm always so doggone hungry. But I sure wasn't going to turn down getting my very first real restaurant food. I grabbed his hand and made sure I gave it a hard squeeze, like Mama told me to, and said,
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir."
He smiled.
"No problem."
Herman E. Calloway said,
"Well, James, like I said, if he's going to be doing some explaining, it's got to be to you.
I don't need to listen to this scamp's nonsense whilst I'm trying to digest my supper.
He stuck a pipe that wasn't lit into his mouth and walked off the stage.
Shucks, if my father had to be so doggone old, I was starting to wish that Lefty Lewis or this Jimmy guy were him. Herman E. Calloway seemed like he was going to be hard to get along with.
The horn player said,
"Little man, my name is Jimmy Wesley. You can call me Mr. Jimmy."
"Yes, sir." He pointed at the younger men.
"The drummer here is Doug the Thug Tennant. The sax man is Harrison Eddie Steady Patrick."
The saxophone player said,
"Oh, man, it's not Eddie Steady. It's Steady Eddie, Steady Eddie Patrick."
Mr. Jimmy said,
"Uh-huh. And on trombone, we have Chug Doo-Doo Bug Cross, and the palest member of the band on piano is Roy Dirty Deed Breed."
He shook his head again and said,
"Lord knows why these young musicians can't just leave the perfectly good names their mamas gave them alone, but for some reason they can't. Anyway, fellas, this here is Bud. What was your last name, Bud?"
"Caldwell, sir."
"This here is Bud Caldwell. He's going to be our guest over at the Sweet Pea for dinner. Y'all say hello to the little man and make him feel comfortable."
The thug said,
"What's the word, Bud?"
Dirty Deed said, "How you doing?"
Doodoo Bug said,
"Welcome, little stuff."
Steady Eddie said,
"Good to meet you, my man."
I said,
"Pleased to meet you."
Mr. Jimmy told them,
"All right, he'll ride over with you four. Me and Herm, we'll meet you there."
The sax man, Steady Eddie, said,
"All right, Mr. Jimmy, we'll finish loading up."
The Jimmy guy went out the front door. The sax man told me,
"Come on, little man. If Mr. Jimmy's going to spring for your supper, the least you can do is help load the car. Grab that case over there and put it in the trunk of the Buick out back."
He pointed to a long, skinny black suitcase that had a leather handle on top of it and said,
"And be careful. That's my bread and butter in there."
I must have looked confused because he told me,
"That's my horn, my axe, my saxophone, the thing I make all my money with. So don't get butterfingers and drop it."
I said, "Oh, yes, sir."
The trombone man, Doodoo Bug, said,
"One thing you're going to have to drop, though, is all that sir stuff. The only two folks around here old enough for you to be calling them sir are Mr. Jimmy and," he winked, "your long-lost dear old daddy."
The whole band busted a gut laughing. The thug guy said, "I'm going to let you in on a little secret, my man. I think the only reason Mr. C is denying he's your daddy is because you went and hurt his feelings."
"How? I didn't do nothing to him."
"There it is. That's just what I mean. Here you two are getting together for the first time, and you didn't show the man no love."
He looked over at Doodoo Bug.
"Bug, did you see any love being passed from this boy to his daddy?"
Doodoo Bug said, "You leave me out of your nonsense." The thug kept going.
"Shoot, man. Seems to me like you should give the man his props. Seems to me like you should have given the man a whole lot more affection. You see, I know Mr. C better than most folks do. I know that beneath that cold-hearted, evil, wicked, nasty, mean..."
Doodoo Bug said,
"Don't forget Cheap. Cheap's got to be in there somewhere."
The thug said, "You know Cheap's right up high on the list. But as I was saying, beneath all that festering nastiness is a tender, kind, loving human being. Why, I'd bet you dollars to donuts that he's outside right now sitting in that packet sobbing openly about how you shunned him. When you get to the Sweet Pea, rush right up on him, give him a big hug, yell out, 'Daddy,' then plant a big, juicy kiss right on the top of his shiny, bald head. Shoot, you do that, and you'll be in his will so quick your head will spin."
I put this thug guy on my list of people not to pay any mind to.
Herman E. Calloway seemed like the kind of person that would rather get bit in the behind by a snaggletooth mule than have somebody give him a kiss.
Steady Eddie said,
"Let's not get the little man killed before he's had a chance to eat, thug. Son, I hope you got sense enough to let what he's telling you go in one ear and find the nearest exit. You just steer clear of Mr. C for a while. He's not someone you want to toy with. And for God's sake, whatever you do, don't call him daddy or papa or anything that's going to give anyone the idea you two are kin. You hear?"
These guys really thought I was dumb.
I said,
"Yes, sir.
But isn't it just like my luck to come clean across the state to find my daddy, and he turned out to be a mean old coot?
I slapped my hand over my mouth. I knew better than saying something like this out loud, but it just fell out of my mouth before I could swallow it down. This was Bud Caldwell's Rules and Things to Have a Funner Life and Make a Better Liar Out of Yourself, number 63. Rules and Things, number 63. Never, ever say something bad about someone you don't know, especially when you're around a bunch of strangers. You never can tell who might be kin to that person or who might be a lip-flapping, big-mouth spy.
Sure enough, the drummer, the thug guy, started acting like he was writing stuff down on a piece of pretend paper. He said, "Let's see, was that mean old coot or old mean coot? Shoot, baby, if I drop some info like this on Mr. C, I might be able to stay in this band longer than the last three drummers did." You see, kid, you ain't the only one trying to get on Mr. C's good side. This is the best drumming gig in the state, and I need to hang on to it as long as I can. I wasn't sure if this drummer guy really was a dirty dog or if he was just a big teaser. Whichever way, I'd have to work real hard on remembering rule and thing number 68. Or was it 63? Steady Eddie said, "Thug, you're going to have to lay off the kid's chops. The little man's got problems enough, and he sure don't need to have you meddling with him. Let's get that car loaded. Me and... what's your name again, kid?"
"Bud, not Buddy, sir."
"Just Bud, not Buddy." "Right. Me and Bud, not Buddy, are too dang hungry to hear any more of your lip." Of all the dusky devastators of the Depression or the Nubian Nights, Steady Eddie is my favorite. We loaded a bunch of funny-shaped black suitcases into the trunk of a big old black Buick, then climbed in. I got in the back seat and sat between Dirty Deed and Steady Eddie with my suitcase on my lap. Doodlebug got behind the steering wheel, and the thug got in beside him. The thug said, "So, Bud, not Buddy, I'ma come right out and ask what's on everyone else's mind. How'd you find out Mr. C was your daddy?"
"My mother let me know."
Thug said, I ain't trying to be funny, and I'd never play the dozens on no one, but let me ask you, was your mama, how can I put this, was your mama as old as sand when she had you?" Steady Eddie said, "Man, leave the kid alone. You got no call to go prying into his life." I never minded talking about my mama, so I told the thug.
"Yes, sir. She was pretty old when I was born."
Thug said, "Shoot, I knew she had to be either old or crazy to have anything to do with that man. How old was she? 80? And was she blind?" I said,
"No, sir. She was old, but her eyes didn't go bad yet. She was 20 when I was born, and she was 26 when she died."
That news always kills any conversation you're having with grown folks. The dusky devastators got as quiet as some mice with bedroom slippers on. The only sound you could hear for a second was the keys cling-clang-clinging up against the metal dashboard as Doodoo Bug turned the car into the front of a little house that had a sign saying the Sweet Pea on it. The thug said, "Things is hard all over, ain't they?" Steady Eddie said, "You're all right, little man. You're a tough little nut. I like that. Most folks your age would be bawling their eyes out if they got teased as hard as that fool drummer was teasing you. But you ain't even close to crying, are you?" I said, "No, sir, I don't know why, but my eyes don't cry no more." Steady Eddie said, "I like that. My eyes don't cry no more. You mind if I borrow that? That sounds like a great name for a song." I said, "No, sir, I don't mind at all." He reached over and rubbed his hand over my head and said, "Yeah, you're all right, little fella. And don't you worry none too much about the thug. Mr. C changes drummers the way most folks change their drawers. What you see in that front seat is a man on borrowed time." The thug said, "Oh, man, what did you hear?" Doodlebug cut the car off and said, "All right, gentlemen, that's enough. Let's go stuff our craws."